Happy New Year. Welcome to Question Period 2017. I'm Evan Solomon, and it will be, let's just say it, a huge year in politics, beginning with Trump's trade tweets.
We have NAFTA, which is a total and complete disaster.
Worries north of the border after threatening tweets from the president-elect Donald Trump unsettled the auto industry. Is Canada a target? We'll head to Washington to find out. Plus, healthcare showdown.
They can't continue to make ultimatums, to make threats, to say that this is take it or leave it.
Provinces demand more money from Ottawa for healthcare, but if they don't get it, how bad will it be for you? Two outspoken provinces join us with their pitch. And then, conservative crossfire.
This brand of negative and divisive politics would drive our party right into the ground.
Can Lisa Raitt really stop Kevin O'Leary from entering the leadership race? She joins us as she puts him in the crossfire. And the big challenges ahead for the government in the new year. This is Question Period. Let's go get some answers.
Bonjour, hello. I'm Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister of Canada.
That's a video plea by the Prime Minister and Canada's ambassador to the United States to Congress, basically saying, don't forget us. They are afraid of Donald Trump's promise of U.S. protectionism.
American and Canadian businesses work closely together to develop and sell our products to the world.
Now, the video was released on the day that U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, Twitter threatened to charge a border tax to General Motors if they move the Chevy Cruze manufacturing plant to Mexico. GM relented. Then Ford decided against a new Mexican assembly plant, although they did say their decision was not directly linked to Trump's threat. The big question, will Canada be a target next? Between the protectionist rhetoric and Trump's battle with the intelligence agencies over the Russian interference in the U.S. election, what to make of the man who will be president in 12 days? To find out, I'm joined now by David Frum, the senior editor of The Atlantic magazine, and Roland Martin, the host of the daily political show TV One Now. Gentlemen, Happy New Year. Good morning, David Frum. I'll start with you. Let me just begin with this issue of trade and the Twitter threats. Is Canada a target?
Canada can't help being a target, even if it's not directly targeted. Canada is a very outward-oriented economy. It depends on a healthy world trading system, not just a healthy bilateral relationship with the United States. So even if somehow Canada is exempted, if a Trump administration does damage to other global trading relationships, Canada will suffer.
Yeah, Roland, what do you make of all these, the Twitter threats to various companies about moving factories outside of the U.S.?
What we are looking at is a bully in chief, a child in chief who is willing to attack anybody, anywhere, who also wants no accountability whatsoever. You know, what is amazing is he'll tweet something then, and he is the leader of false news, the guy who tweets out fake information. He got it wrong this week when it came to General Motors. And he has no problem making any screw-ups. But here's the fundamental problem. This is what is scary to me. I'm sure it's scary to David, and I'm sure it's scary to millions of other Americans. His supporters do not care. When he said during the campaign, I can murder, shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, and my supporters would not care, that's the case. They do not care, and that is the scariest thing in the world.
Yeah, David, of course, outside of the U.S. here, we care, and we don't know what this border tax he talks about might look like. The Canadian ambassador to the U.S. said he believes that the Trump administration views maybe China and Mexico as the trade bad guys, as it were, but Canada is part of the trade good guys. What do you make of that?
Well, as I said, it doesn't matter because Canada also has important trading relationships with China. So if China is pushed into economic crisis of some kind, Canada will feel that, even if the U.S.-Canada border continues to flow. We live in a world of global supply chains. So you can't simply say, we're only slicing certain arteries in your body, other arteries will be fine, because the body depends on the flow of all of the arteries.
All right, let's talk about... Yeah, go ahead, Roland.
It's even worse than that, because remember, he might regard Canada as a friend today, and you might be an enemy in 3 or 4 hours. And so that's part of the problem here. Here's what we know right now. The only country that is safe from any attack from Donald Trump is Putin and Russia.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, this has been the most extraordinary thing. We're talking about trade. Let's just move to that. And David Frommel, you know, you had the head of intelligence agencies today appearing before a Senate Armed Services Committee, all confirming that Russians interfered with the U.S. election. There's some kind of hack. You know, Trump met with intelligence officials. But I guess my question to you is, what have you made about Trump's continual positive tweets about Putin and basically discrediting U.S. intelligence agencies?
Well, he's challenging them, but from my point of view, I give credit to the intelligence agencies, and so do most people, partly because none of this rests on secret information. The evidence is all, the body's on the carpet. The blade is protruding from the shoulder blades, and the wallet is in Donald Trump's pocket. Now, we don't have the fingerprints on the knife. We don't know exactly how the wallet got from the corpse into Donald Trump's pocket, but the whole situation is very suggestive. That the Russians attacked a broad range of American email accounts, the Democratic National Committee, but many others as well, and that they've been doing this for a long time, hundreds per year, by the way, military accounts, military families, military spouses. They've done this in Europe as well. The British have told us that they recorded these attempts in their election last summer. It's going on right now in Germany. So this is a standard method, and what they then do is weaponize the actual information extracted from the Democratic accounts and published by WikiLeaks, which has close ties to Russia. It was pretty boring information, as election information goes. But it was weaponized by the Russian troll army and by Donald Trump himself. You know, a different person might have looked at this information and said, you know, this is how politicians talk. There's no sign of any illegality and no sign really of anything wrong or unethical. There's some kind of rough elbows inside the Democratic Party, some favoritism for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. That's sort of what you would expect to see. Hardly affects the general election. Donald Trump could have said, you know, I'm not going to use this Russian-provided information, but he used it hard, continually, devastatingly. And he had to know where it came from.
Roland.
And Evan, in fact, there are some people who certainly believe that the Trump campaign, the Trump organization, were aware of these emails before they even got out and played a hand in this. And so you have all of this. But I want to give you an example. Imagine if David Frum was driving drunk and mowed down two children. And I said, you know what? I love that guy. He's wonderful. And then imagine David goes out the next day and shoots somebody. And I say, you know what, man, what's wrong with you guys? David's great. No. And then imagine David beats a woman in the middle of the street. Then imagine he does something. No. Follow me here. And here's the problem. At every turn, I go, he's a great guy. You're going to go, does David have something on Roland? Because he won't say anything negative. This is the deal with Trump. You look at this, the entire campaign, nothing negative about Putin or Russia. Nothing. Now president-elect, nothing. Zero, zilch. The guy, he answered during the election about when he was asked about Putin, he said, well, he kills journalists. He goes, well, so do we.
David, what is the deal with Trump's Twitter feed? You've worked in the White House. You understand comms. You know how meetings work. People are reading this Twitter account, which he tweets about Arnold Schwarzenegger's ratings on a reality television show, The Apprentice. He picks a fight with China. What are we to make of Donald Trump's Twitter feed?
It's beyond irresponsible. Look, a president's words are a president's actions. They're heard by the whole world. They are all weighted. Now, presidents are human beings, and they sometimes make slips. Barack Obama is an especially careful president, but even he makes slips about once a year. But the idea that you are, on a daily basis, emitting these unedited, unweighed, untested comments, which have huge impacts on national security, on financial markets, it's astonishing, and it's really dangerous.
Roland,
and in fact, the dangers have already arrived.
His supporters do not care, but he also understands the world we're living in terms of he understands celebrity, he understands entertainment, he's speaking in 140 characters, easily digestible, and so he has mastered this. Those of us who love social media understand how do you build this loyal following. That's what he's done, and as David said, it is tremendously dangerous, but this is a 70-year-old guy who does not care. That's the worst thing in the world.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Roland Martin and David Frum. Roland, I don't know if you want to tell another anecdote about David Frum. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us on Question Period. Oh, great to get your perspective. We are 12 days away from a Trump presidency. Coming up on this program, the standoff between the federal government and most of the provinces over health care continues. Billions of dollars is at stake. Who blinks first? The health ministers from both Manitoba and Quebec are standing by with their demands. Stay with us. Welcome back to Question Period. Well, the provinces are furious. They believe the government is badly shortchanging them on the offer for a new health care accord. They want, well, more money, full stop, after a very tense meeting with the Prime Minister and the ministers back in December. The provinces and territories thought they had a solid coalition, but they didn't. The government quickly cut side deals with Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Newfoundland. This week, health ministers from seven other provinces and the three territories sent a letter to the government asking for another first minister's meeting. What exactly do they want? Let's find out. Joining me now in Manitoba, the health minister there, Kelvin Gertsen, and the health minister in Quebec, Gaétan Barrette. Ministers, good morning to both of you. Minister Gertsen, I'm going to start with you. You sent this letter. What exactly do the provinces want?
Well, good morning. We want what we've always wanted, a real negotiation at the level of the Prime Minister and the Premier. It's what the Prime Minister promised during his election campaign. He said he would sit down with the Premiers and have a real discussion about a long-term sustainable funding agreement for healthcare. So I think the Prime Minister has to fulfill his word, meet with the Premiers and negotiate, not call us to Ottawa to drop a unilateral take-it-or-leave-it deal. He could have sent an email if he wanted to do that, but instead they crowd all of us into Ottawa. Everybody got onto an airplane, paid for hotels and taxis and that sort of thing, and then dropped a unilateral deal. I mean, that's, you wouldn't negotiate buying a car that way. Why would you negotiate a health agreement that way?
Well, okay, let me get to Quebec Health Minister Gaétan Barrette. Look, you know that under the Harper formula, the Canadian health transfer was supposed to drop at the minimum to 3% a year, but or at the rate of nominal GDP. The government's talking about 3.5%. They seem to be ready to negotiate more, maybe a nominal GDP, but they've got their own growth problems. What is your red line? What is the deal that you would take right now?
Well, the deal is about sustainability, which is not what is offered on the table today. It's not sustainability at all because they're reducing funding, first of all. And second of all, we have to address
Minister, they're still increasing funding. They're reducing it from the current levels you have, but they're still going to be increasing funding on an annual year.
Yeah, but that's my whole point. The whole point is that as what it was before is going to be a decrease in funding over time. And at a time where the population is aging and the needs are increasing, we were not happy with the Conservatives' position. We're not happy with the Liberal position. And we're not happy because the Liberals came out, were elected with the promise of investing $3 billion in home care, which was in many ways quite a good idea. But they are taking that money away from home care to put it in other issues. And on total, they're reducing the funding.
Okay, but to be fair, sir, healthcare funding across Canada is only increasing on a provincial level at under 3%. Why do you want 5.7% from the government? Like, that's a huge chunk of money when it's more than than our economy is going, growing, and it's more than you're already spending on healthcare in your own provinces.
I can talk about Quebec on this one. Over the 10 years that the last accord lasted, we invested year over year an average of 5.8% increases year over year. It is true that the past 2 years, because we wanted to balance the budget, we slowed the spending down. But we will go back at proper levels as of this year. But over the 10 years of the last agreement, we in Quebec, and I'm sure it is the same thing in other provinces and territories, we increase our healthcare budgets by 5.8% per year. So that's the reality. And Ottawa is coming out and saying, okay, last 2 years, because you balance your budget, you reduce spending, and because of that, for the next 10 years, we will reduce ours. Those who won't have access to care are seniors and handicapped people, autistic patients that will not have proper access to home care, for instance, because it's broken, a broken promise from the federal part?
Let me get to Minister Gertsen from Manitoba. Manitoba has said you won't sign on to the Prime Minister's carbon price, right? The national price on carbon, unless you get a health care deal. Does that remain the case? No health care deal, no signature on the climate plan.
Well, it remains the case because what we have is we have an uncertainty. We don't know what the funding is going to be for healthcare, so we don't know what our healthcare costs are going to be. That accounts for half the, close to half the budget of Manitoba. That would be similar in other provinces as well. There are costs that are involved with the carbon plan. You're going to be investing in green projects and green programs. So Manitoba is already the most energy efficient and green province in Canada by virtue of Manitoba Hydro, but we don't know what those costs are going to be, and if we don't know what we're going to be getting in terms of funding or if we're going to be getting sufficient funding in healthcare, it's difficult to commit to other things.
Let's say you don't get a deal. Well, you know the finance minister's got to book his budget and he's probably got till the end of the month to do it. What they could just impose a deal, minister. What do you do then?
This is a national issue. I mean, what they're doing with the provinces and trying to separate the provinces is a threat to universal health care. And if the Prime Minister isn't interested in universal health care, if he wants to have side deals, if he wants to underfund health care because he wants to somehow dismantle the universal health care system, well, then have that discussion and say it.
All right.
But he should be having that discussion with the premiers.
I got to leave it there.
There is one thing that I know, Evan. One thing that I know is that Mr. Trudeau doesn't want to come to the table because he knows very well that our numbers are right. He knows very well that he will decrease funding. He knows very well that this will have an impact, a negative impact, in access to care. He knows that. He doesn't want to get at the table because he's going to have to face the reality.
Yeah, but what
but
do you do about it?
We have
what
to
do you
face.
Do about it is the question.
Well, the question here is
well,
for us
to fight
go
for
public, and that's what we are doing. We are. That's exactly what we are doing, and we provinces and territories have the responsibility to provide, deliver those services, and we have to answer our population. When things go sour, we are the ones who are criticized by everybody. I can understand that, but we're supposed to have a partner. Is Ottawa being a partner today? The answer to that is no.
Quebec Health Minister Gaétan Barré and Manitoba Health Minister Calvin Gertsen. Gentlemen, Happy New Year to you. We'll all be watching to see how this thing unfolds. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so interesting you note there, the Manitoba Health Minister saying his province will still not sign on to the federal carbon plan if they don't increase those health care transfers. But what about Ontario's carbon pricing? That started January 1st. Coming up next on the program is the carbon price the cause of pain at the gas pumps. The Ontario Finance Minister, Charles Souza, is standing by next. Stay with Question Period.
I noticed this morning that it went up pretty high.
It's ridiculous.
Not happy at all. I don't understand why they keep jumping up this much.
That's a little hard to hit in the wallet.
Some Ontario and Alberta residents not enjoying a Happy New Year on January 1st after a spike in gas prices, almost 5 cents a liter, affected by the provincial government's new fight to curb carbon emissions. This is where political rhetoric hits reality. When the carbon price hits the price of gas, that's reality. In an effort to combat climate change, companies burning fossil fuels are now being charged by the government, and those costs are obviously being passed on to you, the consumer. There's also concern from some businesses, like automakers, well, Premier Bradwell in Saskatchewan as well, that Canada will be less able to compete with a Trump administration that is intent on ignoring climate concerns and one promising to lower corporate taxes. How much pain will you feel at the pump? And what about the future for manufacturing and the economy? To find out about this, I'm joined by Ontario's Finance Minister, Charles Souza. Happy New Year to you, Minister Souza. Let's start with the pain at the pumps. What do you tell consumers who said, look, man, we're already suffering here. I don't want to spend 5 cents more a liter.
So in Canada, there's a requirement now right across the country to put some form of carbon premiums on the pricing of carbon. You can have a carbon tax, or you can go with the cap and trade scenario, which what we've done with the Western Climate Initiative with Quebec and California, for example. It's a much more cost-effective measure, and it reduces emissions. It's proven to do so. It's a carbon tax that's being proposed elsewhere is four times higher than what it is that we're proposing. Bottom line, though, is what we need to invest and reinvest dollar for dollar all those proceeds to become more efficient and reduce costs over time.
Okay, so where's the money going? A lot of people want to know. Patrick Brown, the progressive conservative leaders accusing this as a grab, that you're taking the money to pay for your programs. Where is the money going?
Well, Patrick Brown's alternative is four times more expensive than what we're proposing through a cap and trade scenario, and it's at the wholesale level where they trade allowances. The money, by law, has to be reinvested dollar for dollar in the very programs that enable us to reduce emissions and promote a green economy, a new sector for us to be leaders in the green sector. And that is happening. Ontario is actually taking quite a leadership by getting out of coal, for example, that's decarbonized the system and it's not impacting on electricity prices to the extent that it would if there was a carbon tax imposed.
To be fair, the bottom line is higher gas prices, lots of tax dollars going to something that the Auditor General has said might not actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions and might not even be that efficient. I mean, how do you make the case when people are paying more for a system that may not be that great?
Well, the question is, can it be? And of course it can. That's why the Auditor General is making suggestions as to what can be done and what may be challenging. And we recognize those challenges. That's why we've taken the precautions that are necessary through the cap and trade program to both reduce emissions and improve economic growth. And we have a number of programs in place to mitigate some of the costs. But as I said again, in Canada, it's required now to put some form of premium on carbon. And a cap and trade system is much more efficient, much more cost effective, and it reduces more emissions. Where there's a cap tax, where there's a carbon tax now, for example, in British Columbia, the mitigation it hasn't really occurred and emissions have gone up. We need to do better, and that's why we've embraced the cap and trade system.
In the current context, as you know, we're about to enter a different world. In 12 days, Donald Trump will become the president. He's already said he does not support a price on carbon. He already said he's going to reduce the corporate income tax. He's also said that he is a Buy American protectionist president. He's tweeted about a Toyota plant that is planning to move to California. It's actually located here in Canada. He said any plant that moves from the U.S. and tries to export goods back to the U.S. will pay a border tax. How concerned are you that jobs in Ontario will no longer be able to compete in the U.S. because of the carbon tax, because of the low income tax there, and because of Trump's Buy Americanism?
So a couple of things. The income tax rate for corporations in the United States is much higher than it is in Ontario. They're only now playing catch up and they're trying to become more competitive. Ontario has been a top destination for foreign direct investment in all of North America for a number of years now. And when it comes to the auto sector, let's be mindful. I think the president-elect will come to realize that they rely heavily on the Ontario market. We buy $59 billion worth of assembled and parts manufacturing from the United States, more than we produce. And that symbiotic relationship, that integrated supply chain, is critical to the Great Lakes Cluster, the largest in North America. So there is a relationship and a requirement for the states to have with Canada for their benefit as well. Hundreds of thousands of jobs in the United States are reliant on the Canadian marketplace, as is Ontario.
But Donald, how do you know that Donald Trump, when he says any factory that tries to import back into the U.S. will not, he says they're going to be subject to a border tax. Why? He says that for Mexico, we're involved in NAFTA. Why are you so sure that this will not apply to Canada?
Evan, because we are a net importer of products from the United States. We buy more than we make. We buy more than we export. They're relying on our marketplace as well, $59 billion. There's $680 billion worth of trade with Canada and the United States. Half of that trade is here in Ontario. That relationship is critical to the well-being of the very sectors, the very states that elected Donald Trump. And the governors of those states have had MOUs with Ontario to promote that trade and strengthen that relationship because they're reliant on Ontario.
Are you concerned that this could be a trade war, though? Are you concerned that if he does protectionism and Buy Americanism and he rips up NAFTA, that there could be a kind of tit-for-tat trade war here?
Well, if it happens, if that's the line of questioning and promotion by the president-elect, he's risking a big part of their exports, which is the largest buyer coming from Ontario. They need that relationship to exist for their very manufacturing base. And I believe that'll be very clear. The ambassadors, the current ambassador, the previous ambassadors from the United States to Canada have always commented that every car produced in Ontario, 25% of that component is comes from the United States. They rely heavily on us as well.
Okay, last question. Do you think that the national price on carbon will make Canada less competitive against the U.S.? That's what Rick Santorum, U.S. politician, told us on this program. He said, go for it, guys. You'll become less competitive. Do you believe the national price on carbon makes Canadian goods less competitive in the United States?
What we're doing is taking leadership in the low-carbon economy. Its demands are huge all across the world. China is investing more in green economic initiatives, and Ontario has been leading the charge. We recognize the importance of that economic priority, and when it comes to being competitive, Ontario's taken a number of steps to become more competitive against the United States and other parts of the world. It's advanced manufacturing, it's new skills and technology, it's improving our marketplace and our trade. Listen, California has been embracing cap and trade for a number of years, and their economy has been growing and their employment has been growing. Here in Ontario, we just released job numbers that show greater jobs year over year, 80,000 more jobs, net new jobs, high-paying jobs, and primarily right. in the full-time and private sector.
That is true, although that's the first report in a long time. I got to leave it there. Charles Souza, great to have you back in the program, sir. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Evan.
Coming up on Question Period, is there a growing split in the Conservative Party leadership race? Maybe like the division in the Republican Party down south. Candidate Lisa Raitt is next on why she's trying to stop Kevin O'Leary from entering the race, and then the Scrum will weigh in on the infighting. That's all next on Question Period. Stay with us.
I'm calling on every Canadian concerned that Kevin O'Leary and Kelly Leach shouldn't be leading this party.
Well, the gloves are off at last when Conservative leadership candidate Lisa Raitt put out a Stop Kevin O'Leary website. It kicked off a genuine bout of infighting in the Conservative Party. Lisa Raitt says both Kevin O'Leary and rival candidate Kelly Leach have embraced Trump-style politics that will permanently damage the Conservative Party. Immediately, her rival candidate Kelly Leach tweeted that Raitt, quote, stands with the Liberals and the media elites. Why did Lisa Raitt do it? Let's find out. I'm joined by Lisa Raitt now. Happy New Year to you.
You too, Evan. Thanks.
Why did you put out a website saying stop Kevin O'Leary? The guy hasn't even entered the race yet.
Oh, he's around. He's been to our debates. He's doing a lot of television. And for your own television, you know that he has stepped away from CTV because he's considering it. So he's pretty much in there, and I think he's there for fair comment. I would say this. The reason why we won in 2011 was because we had a unified party. Stephen Harper, Peter McKay, Jason Kenney, everybody came together to work under the banner of a unified Conservative Party that was there to help people. And unfortunately, the language from Kevin O'Leary's past comments and how Kelly is approaching the campaign now both lead us in a path where we can't win in 2019, I fear. And we need to win. If you look at any of the jobs, any of the financial information coming out of this Liberal government, Trudeau has to be taken out and not taken out, but Trudeau must be defeated in 2019. And that's what's important. That's what okay. we need to focus on and pick the leader to do that.
But when you put up a website, Stop Kevin O'Leary, when you call out Kelly Leach, it sounds like you're being divisive.
What I'm doing is I'm showing people that there is going to be some significant baggage associated with these two candidates for leader if they were to be elected leader. I think that's fair game because we're the ones who are going to be running under the banner. And, you know, Kelly writes that I'm a Liberal or I'm the media elite. What do the people in Milton, Ontario think when they see that she's calling me a Liberal? I'm not a Liberal. I'm a Conservative, and I'm going to run as a Conservative in the next election. So she's not even helping those who are going to be there to carry the party banner in the future.
Lisa Raitt, is this more than just a leadership now? Are the stakes high enough? Is this a battle for the identity of the Conservative Party? I mean, you keep invoking Donald Trump here. Is that what's at stake here?
Well, I think in any leadership campaign, the leader has to show the vision. My vision is a united party. That includes people who belong to unions. That includes people who are concerned about immigration, but on the other hand, view immigration as a benefit. Those who agreed with Jason Kenney and Stephen Harper and how we balanced immigration then. So I believe that inherent in any leadership campaign, because in 2019, the campaign's face and the campaign's tone is going to be set by the leader. And I just want people to know exactly what Kevin has said in the past
okay,
and
but
what
is
Kelly
this,
is saying
is
now
the, it,
doesn't help
is
us.
Is the identity of the Conservative Party of Canada at stake here?
The identity is Big Ten. The identity is that we have to be unified with every aspect of a Conservative voter recognized as having an important policy voice, but we have to go outside of our party to win majority elections. And that's what we did in 11, and we know the path, and it's unification, and that's how we do it. But we need to make sure that we're not alienating people who are in unions, Canadian forces, or in Kelly's case, alienating those who disagree with her opinions on policy.
All right, definitely the race is heating up. Lisa Raitt, thanks for joining us today on Question Period. Appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Evan.
All right, that's Lisa Raitt. What to make of the division inside the Conservative Party? Clearly growing. What are the biggest challenges ahead for the Prime Minister in 2017? Lots to talk about. I'm joined now by our scrum. Laura Stone, reporter for the Globe and Mail, is here. Joyce Napier, CTV bureau chief, is here. Craig Oliver, CTV's chief political commentator, is here. And our special guest today, Nick Nanos, chairman of Nanos Research. Happy New Year to everyone. Let's get at it, Nick. You saw Lisa Raitt, the Stop Kevin O'Leary website. What does all this tell you about the Conservative race?
That the Conservatives have forgotten who their enemy is. They're fighting each other, not realizing that the real enemy, at least for them, is Justin Trudeau and the Liberals. They're going to tear themselves apart, and they got to pull together if they want to topple this government.
No, they have to fight. They have to fight. Absolutely. They have to fight among themselves in order to decide who they are. And what she did is she opened wide the divisions, the fissures which we all knew existed between the Conservatives, who basically want to reproduce the Harper era. The kind of government Harper had, a populist government, sort of mean-spirited, right of center, or to return to the kind of party they've won with so many times over the years, a generous, progressive conservative party, although they may not call it that. That's what the division is now. That's clear.
All right. It was interesting that Lisa Raitt, Joyce, used the word Trump repeatedly as if O'Leary and Leach are trying to Trumpify the Conservatives, and she's trying to protect the party. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I mean, I kind of tend to agree with Craig. They've got to fight now. This is what it's all about. Fight and decide what your label will be. Will you be more libertarian like Maxime Bernier? Are you going to be social conservatives? Are you going to be Trumpists or whatever the name of the name is? What do you want to be, and what do you want to be going forward to fight, in fact, that enemy, which is the Liberal Party? They don't even know what they are yet. Are they going to be the Leach? Is it going to be Leach and O'Leary? Right. Or will it be a sort of more laissez-faire Maxime Bernier kind of thing? Who may end up by being the dark horse?
By the way, Kevin O'Leary does jump into this race. I mean, I'll say it here. There's no doubt in my mind that he will jump into the race. Laura, what do you think this says about the race?
Well, what Raitt has done is totally legitimize Kevin O'Leary's candidacy. She's gone after him because he's the front runner in all the internal polls and all the polls that we're seeing through the mainstream. Of leading this Conservative Party race. He's not even in the race yet. He's the most popular candidate. He's the most well-known. I think it's interesting that Lisa Raitt went after Kevin O'Leary instead of Kelly Leach, who has much more divisive policies out there in terms of immigration.
Well, she did go after her, although it's the Stop Kevin O'Leary website, but she talked as much about Kelly Leach.
She looped them in together, but Kevin O'Leary hasn't shown any propensity towards those kind of divisive social policies. Right. So I think that was interesting. So clearly Kevin O'Leary is the front runner in this race, and that's why she chose to go after him.
How important is French, by the way? Kevin O'Leary doesn't speak French. You know, he's being baited about getting inside the French debate. He's not going to declare before then. We know that. Is that really a big problem for him, Nick?
Well, it's probably not a big problem within the Conservative Party, but he has to have some sort of commitment that someday he will be kind of functional in French if he wants to be Prime Minister. You know, mathematically, the Tories don't need Quebec to come back. They never have had Quebec. They've only had a marginal breakthrough. So, you know, it won't be as much of an issue in the party, but
in the leadership race, though, when every riding is weighted the same, it does matter. I've heard he's meeting the Quebec caucus, Craig, on January 11th, or whoever will attend.
Quebecers can deliver huge numbers to whoever wins this convention. So he does need support from Quebec. He needs it very badly. But there was a time in history, but the John Diefenbaker days will never come back. I think he is very limited in his ability to form a majority government ever if he doesn't learn to speak French well.
And last word on this.
The young people also who are becoming more and more bilingual today in Canada. And yes, I think that you have to be bilingual. You don't have to speak French like Victor Hugo, but you've got to be able to speak French properly to be able to talk to one third of the population of Canada.
I like your benchmark there, George. That's good. The Victor Hugo benchmark.
Yeah,
all right,
we'll
have to use
benchmark.
That. All right, Justin Trudeau has announced he's going on a cross-country tour. Will actually take place over 3 weeks, Maybe he's trying to reconnect after a ragged end of the year and all the fundraising issues. Craig, I'll start with you. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the biggest challenges facing Trudeau and maybe what this has to do with this sudden announcement about the tour?
Well, I think the biggest challenge really is to manage the U.S. relationship and the Trump gang after January 20th. But if you're asking me domestically where Trudeau needs to go, I mean, the problem is in the weeks before the new year, he was losing support. He still had support. Many prime ministers would be happy to have, but he was dropping off strongly. People were unhappy about these wealthy meetings with people grinding their own economic axe and him entertaining them for $1,500. So I think he wants to go out and see real Canadians and say, hey, real Canadians, you can meet with me for nothing if you want to. Mind you, if you want to come to a private, wealthy, some kind of mansion over a couple of blocks away and you got $1,500, maybe you can talk to me longer.
Maybe that's it. What do you make of this, the biggest challenge ahead?
I think it's going to be the deficit. Four words, not in your lifetime. Yes. It will not be balanced in your lifetime, right? And he's talking about 2050, and it will play to what people always worry about the Liberals that they run. You know, they're okay with deficits for specific purposes, but this whole idea of not running, not being able to balance the books until 2050 is going to come back to bite them.
Yeah, slow growth. Laura.
I think that Prime Minister Trudeau has to convince Canadians he's still the guy that they can trust. You mentioned the economy, deficits now running into 2050. He's the guy who's going to bring pipeline construction to Canada, as he's promised. He's the guy who can negotiate with the Trump administration, who is likely going to reopen NAFTA. And what does that mean for trade in the auto manufacturing sector? Ethics as well, that he's the guy they can still trust. He's not only going to meet with rich Canadians. So that's what I think. I think he's going on a trust tour to reintegrate to Canadians that he's their guy to trust in 2017.
Trust, okay, what do you think, Joyce?
Plus, he does that well. He did that well during the campaign, so he's going to some comfort level where he can actually go and talk to Canadians because that worked. His communication skills will be, you know, put to good use there. But I agree with Nick. The deficit is definitely something that worries Canadians a lot. And his dealings with the administration, that's going to be a tough one, because if they're not getting along, then the Canadian economy, it will for sure have an impact on the Canadian economy. Therefore, it will have an impact on us all, and we'll like him a lot less.
Yeah, the economy, slow growth, they got the Morneau budget, and of course, dealing with Trump as of January 20th, this will be the single most difficult challenge for any prime minister, but specifically in this case. All right, we're going to take a short break. I want to thank Laura Stone from the Globe and Mail for joining us. Great to see Laura back. Coming up next, Trump's impact on Canada. Is a trade war coming? Nick's got some new numbers on that, Canadians' attitude, and also we got a special guest from Washington to weigh in. Stay with Question Period. Welcome back to Question Period. Well, with Donald Trump tweeting about the new age of Buy American protectionism, should Canada be worried about a potential trade war with the U.S.? Let's bring back the scrum, Joyce Napier, Craig Oliver, Nick Nanos from Nanos Research, and our special guest for this part of the program in Washington, our friend Scotty Greenwood from the Canada-American Business Council. All right, let's start with Scotty. Trump threat tweeting that companies that move out of the U.S. might face a punitive border tax. Scotty, should Canada be worried?
Canada would be right to be worried. And, you know, we are actually in uncharted waters when it comes to all of this. I mean, how many 70-year-old guys do you know that tweet, first of all, and how many billionaires and heads of companies manage their own Twitter accounts? So that in and of itself is uncharted waters. And there are all kinds of boards of directors throughout North America and the world that are asking themselves, finally, I thought Twitter was for my grandchildren and for reporters. What is it really? But in terms of Canada be worried about border tax? Absolutely. You know, one of the things about Buy American provisions, they refer to procurement, right? And it sort of makes sense that if you're spending government dollars, taxpayer dollars, that you would show a preference, either if you're Canadian for Canadian goods, if you can get them, American for American. So the politics are pretty good.
Well, Charles Souza was on the show, Nick, earlier, the finance minister of Ontario, and he's trying to say, look, the numbers show that it just doesn't make sense for Donald Trump to treat Canada the way he's threatening to treat Mexico. I don't know if that necessarily makes sense. You've done some research, though, on Canadians' attitude towards this. What do they say?
Well, you know, we asked Canadians on what they think about a potential renegotiation of NAFTA, and they are worried. They think we're going to be on the short end of the stick, that it's very unlikely that it's going to be good news for Canada, but they're ready to fight. You know, it's a bit of the Irish in them. They're willing to put tariffs on U.S. goods if the U.S. pulls out of NAFTA. So on the one hand, we know it's going to be very difficult. On the other hand, we're ready to do stuff.
You know what? It may make people feel better. The idea of retribution is always a wonderful thing. But it would be very unwise to take that view because we have an asymmetrical relationship with the United States. Our prosperity really depends on our economic relationship with them. If we get into a tit for tit fight with the United States over who gets what in terms of taking actions against each other's products, we will lose.
Yeah, but I think they call that, Craig, a tweet for tat.
But I think for Canadians, right. They just don't want us to roll over. They know that we're going to lose, but they don't want us to roll over, at least for this particular president.
We have China. We can play our China card, and that's what we should do. The Chinese are already warning the Americans actions they're going to take if they bring sanctions against Chinese goods. The Chinese will be looking to us. We'll be happy to do business with them. We're wide open.
Joyce, let me just bring Joyce in. $800 billion a year in two-way trade with the U.S., $70 to $80 billion with China. So the second place trading is far behind. What do you think about this? Does Canada get sideswiped in all this?
Well, you know, I mean, Canadian officials are not duped. They understand what's going on, although nobody really knows what Donald Trump is actually going to do. So they've had several meetings, in fact, 12 meetings so far, between people from the Prime Minister's office, his principal secretary, his chief of staff, with, you know, high-ranking officials in the Trump administration, Jared Kushner, Stephen Bannon. They are meeting. Right? And their last meeting was this week, in fact, in New York City. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to tell these newcomers, these newbies, because that's what they are, this is who we are, this is how we trade, this is what we mean to 35 of your states, because we are the export partners of 35 U.S. states, the main export partners. So they're trying as best they can, obviously, in this context, to tell them what we're all about and how integrated our economies are. A car crosses the border 10 to 15 times, right? So it would hurt them too.
Maybe we need a trade intervention, right? One of those things with Canada, Mexico, and China. Because if we fall into the Donald Trump bilateral negotiation game, he's going to win. Everybody's going to lose.
You don't know that.
I don't necessarily agree with that.
Okay, Scotty Greenwood, go ahead.
Sure. Well, look, I think that it would be better. I agree with Joyce that the Canadian government, the officials, the political people, Ambassador David McNaughton, are incredibly shrewd. They know what's going on, and they're getting ready. That having been said, I would respectfully disagree with Craig on the China question, because